Hello and welcome to the next episode of Research VR, where we dig deep beyond the realms of virtual reality. You're joined by me, the usual co-host Peter Lekhoff, as well as Krzysztof Zdebski.
Hello.
And by Dominik Escoffier.
Hello everyone.
Today, we will talk about the rendering challenges in virtual reality, and I'm pretty sure that Dominik is the right guest because he's in fact from NVIDIA and has a lot of insights. Not all of them he can share, but I hope at least some. So you gave today a very good talk here on the
HANO VR, one of the biggest meetups in Germany.
And what was it about?
It was about the rendering challenges of virtual reality. So what kind of problems you have when rendering for VR, what types of latency you want to get out of the pipeline, the types of things you can do to enhance your performance, to get more out of the GPU that you already have, and also the special challenges that VR offers for those rendering problems.
Let's start basic. So how does the whole rendering pipeline in general work? You have the game engine that pipes the data.
So usually when you're rendering for a game engine, the GPU is mostly there for all the 3D geometry, for the pixel shaders, and all of these different things. But when you're talking about VR, there are a couple of other different things. So a typical VR pipeline looks a little bit different because for rendering the actual view, first you get the head pose of the sensors of the headset. And then that position and translational data is getting sent to the CPU, which then computes the image that the GPU has to provide to the display in the headset. So those are the main steps: is you get the head pose from the headset, that goes to the CPU, that then goes to the GPU, and the GPU then outputs that to the display. And since we're mostly using low persistence displays in virtual reality headsets, you only get a short backlight flash of the LED display, and then that image gets then transported via photons into your retina.
How does a game engine play inside the role? So the head rotation information goes into the CPU, which basically runs a game engine. The game engine determines where you're looking at, what happens there, particle effects, and then basically pushing the rendering commands to the GPU, right? So the GPU is just a piece of hardware that just renders. It doesn't do any calculation that changes anything, right?
It does a ton of calculations, but only for graphical assets. So yes, all the information is getting sent by the CPU, and what the GPU then does and what it's specialized on is rendering the 3D geometry, projecting that 3D geometry onto a 2D plane, which usually means your monitor. In the case of virtual reality, it means the two displays that are side by side on your in your headset.
Now, VR involves usually stereoscopic vision, so it has rendered two images, or does it render them simultaneously as one image? How does it work?
It's like usually, camera. A couple of years before, the traditional rendering pipeline looked just like a game pipeline. So what you did is you rendered a view for the left eye and you rendered a view for the right eye, and you had to do both geometry passes as well as shadings and all the other stuff that's involved. What we can do now with more modern hardware, for example, the Maxwell series and the Pascal series of NVIDIA, so the 900 series or the 10 series, or the 1070 or 970, there are a couple of things implemented inside on the chip itself. So there are a couple of things that you can use from a software side that are being enhanced or computed faster due to the fact that we have some implementations on the hardware itself. One of them is the geometry pass, for example. So just as I said before, usually you did two complete renderings, one for the left eye, one for the right eye. What you can do with a system called single pass stereo is you use the same geometry information and extract the two viewpoints from that single information. So instead of doing two geometry passes, one for the left, one for the right eye, you only do one geometry pass and then extract the information for the two
images. Are they exactly the same or slightly corrected for the position of the
eye? They are completely corrected. So they are corrected for the actual view that you have. But in essence, you save one geometry pass. So instead of doing two geometry passes for one frame, you're doing one geometry pass only.
And you do it, I guess, to save latency, which is one of the biggest issues in rendering.
In that case, you're using it mostly for performance enhancements. So what that means is because you put less pressure onto the geometry, onto the geometry part of the GPU, you actually can use more geometry in your scene, so you can have a more complex scene geometry-wise, or you can use that saved performance for other parts in the VR experience. So, for example, for particle effects or correct simulation of cloth or fluids.
what is performance in this context? What are the key performance indicators in this particular case?
The key performance indicators for VR are a little bit tricky because you have to render at 90 FPS, which essentially means you have about 7 times to 8 times the amount of throughput that you have compared to a normal gaming monitor. So if you're looking at a gaming monitor that runs a full HD game at 30 FPS, that's about 60 megapixels per second of bandwidth that you're pushing through the pipeline. If you're rendering for VR, you have 2 screens and you push both of these screens at 90 FPS, which puts you at about 450 megapixels per second. So that's about 7 times the amount of workload that the GPU has to do. And that's also the reason why you need these rendering tricks to actually enhance the performance so you get more frames out of it. You have a more stable experience even on lower end hardware. That's the main KPI.
So what are the problems of rendering in general except performance and latency? Is there anything else?
Performance and latency are definitely the most important parts. Performance because of the 90 FPS that you have to get, which is a lot. Usually games like a typical Call of Duty game that runs at 30 FPS or at 60 FPS, that is an addition. And then what you named is also very important is the latency part. So from the time you move your head till the photon actually hits your retina, that amount of time should be as short as possible. And a couple of studies have showed that the magic threshold is about 20 milliseconds. So if your motion to photon latency is below that rate, you don't tend to realize that you're looking at a display and you don't get any negative effects like motion sickness, for example, which can also happen if the latency goes higher than 20 milliseconds. What you see as a user is essentially the image is following, is trailing your head movements. It isn't right where your brain expects it to be. It's a little bit delayed.
Just take the Oculus DK1 and experience.
Yeah, exactly. That was exactly that. So it was running at 60 FPS and had a
no low persistence.
Don't quote me on that, but I think it had about 50 milliseconds of latency, somewhere around there.
And no time warp, which compensates the fact when sometimes a frame cannot be calculated.
Exactly. Perceived latency is something that we definitely should talk about later on because there's a couple of things in the trick set that you can pull.
Yeah. Oh, one step back. Now, the GPU has not only the clock and the performance speed it can do, like not only the gigabits per second it can calculate, right? But also memory, right? And when we speak about more megapixels that it needs to push out per second or per frame, you need more memory. So is memory also an issue?
Memory is not as much of an issue for VR. It is important, obviously, but things like latency, so how fast you can put that image out is actually more important. In general, what the memory helps with is large textures. So if you have lots of geometry and large texture sets on those parts of geometry, you use more texture memory. That itself takes up a lot of space. But in general, what you want to have is as much bandwidth as possible at as low latency as possible.
Okay, and what are the next steps after you determine those rendering problems?
The next steps are for our research and development teams and also our tech teams to actually implement those concepts they come up with and put them into the hardware and then also use our VRWorks SDK to actually speak with the hardware in a way that enhances the performance even further. So VRWorks is maybe something that's interesting to the developer audience that's listening to the podcast. VRWorks is a set of different tools or different SDKs that all help to enhance the performance of a virtual reality experience.
How much effort do I need to put as a developer to implement those SDKs? What's the pipeline here for a developer?
That's actually the question I ask most of developers for feedback. How long did it take you to put that in? And what I get from from the talks to developers, it's about half a day to a day of work to actually implement VRWorks. Okay. If you're using Unity and Unreal, it might even be easier because those engines are already supporting VRWorks in a couple of branches. So it's not that big amount of work, and you get a lot of value out of it because all these things...
How much value are we talking about?
Well, the value you're getting out is you don't have to care about the background rendering stuff. So essentially, in an ideal world, you tick a box in Unity, and then you get all the performance enhancements through single pass stereo. That's one of the things that I just talked about is where you actually put lower pressure onto the geometry part. And then there's also a couple of other things. And what that means for you as a developer is you can use your resources instead of getting whatever 5 or 10 or 15% more performance out of your application. You can just use VRWorks and you get like you get that performance for free, and you can use those resources for whatever creative processes to make your experience better, you name it.
Have basically a more beautiful experience in general.
Exactly. So it opens up more performance for actually cool effects like particle effects or cloth simulation or fluid simulation, things that make a VR experience much more immersive.
So what would be the process of implementing VRWorks? So my question is basically, why does it take half a day to a day?
That usually has to do because you also have to read our SDK tutorials, for example.
So basically we understand it.
Yeah, basically understand, because you don't want to implement something that just for the sake of it. You want to understand the process behind it, and then also what you can do with it is very important. And we have a developer website that actually relaunched a short time ago, where we now have a lot of tutorial stuff for every part of the VRWorks SDK, because there's not only the rendering things like single pass stereo, multi-res shading, we also have audio implemented.
So surround.
3D audio. So essentially, what many people are forgetting is that audio is super important for VR. I mean, many people are saying it, audio is super important, but then in the end, it's always treated a little bit lackluster. And again, our SDK more or less takes that amount of work off of you. So you don't have to think about your own whatever 3D audio pipeline, but you can use our audio SDK that's actually based on our optics ray tracing engine. So how it's quite a funny story. How sound propagates through a room is quite similar to how light actually bounces through a room. So
those are waves, right?
It's all waves in essence, and since you can use ray tracing for doing the same thing for graphics, you can use that same algorithm and use it in the audio SDK. So that means that get a full full traced path audio. You get things like reverb or how the geometry in the room is constructed,
the echo, and also
the echo, all those things. And that is very important because, I mean, I don't have to tell you, we're sitting here with high-end podcast equipment.
Yeah. Exactly.
And we know exactly about things like, how does a room sound?
Yeah.
When you're going into a church or into a subway station, they sound completely different. Like the moment, even if you would close your eyes and you would walk into a place like this, you feel the atmosphere. Yeah. You know how far the walls are away. Things like that, your brain is very much trained
to
realize.
What else do you provide? Except
one more thing to the audio. It's actually extremely fascinating to me because we had a project at the university a year or two before I joined the university at Osnabrück that they actually had to abandon because it was about the spatial audio and it was way too complex to build it 5 years ago.
It's pretty complex.
To the point where they simulated exactly one room with the exact position of the loudspeaker and the person.
I mean,
and that's about as much as they could do in a year or two of
development. In fact, 1 year ago on the CeBIT, I got also in a heavy discussion with someone about exactly the topic. And he was like saying, it's not possible to ray trace sound. It's just too much or you can't do it. And I was like saying, okay, there are algorithms, there's hardware, just throw some calculation power on it. And now I also hear that there's some kind of magic SDKs that from NVIDIA at least can do it, right?
Of course, it's not. It is always an approximation of the real world because physics are pretty complex. But that approximation through ray casting is pretty powerful. So that is definitely helpful.
And here I have a follow-up question to the fluid simulation and other simulations that you're doing with your physics. How realistic are those simulations? How big approximation do you need to take for your simulation, or are you taking for your simulations?
It depends on how much of a graphic whore you are, you know, where some people are really like it cannot be as realistic as it is in the real world. Even if you would have a perfect simulation, those people would probably say
exactly,
this doesn't look real.
And that goes into a topic we will postpone a little bit. Let's just focus right now. What else does the SDK provide except audio and the geometry?
So there's a couple things. First of all, the geometry part is taken care of by single pass stereo.
Yes.
Then we have
audio.
Things that put lower pressure on the pixel shader. So those are multi-res shading and lens matched shading. And there's a special case in VR because you're looking through lenses at a display. there's warping involved.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the warping essentially leads to part of the image that are on the display that you don't need to render because you don't see them anyway, because they vanish in your peripheral vision. And multi-res shading takes that into account and profits from it. So what multi-res shading does, it takes the outer part of the image that are in the peripheral vision anyway, that gets warped a lot, and renders that part at lower resolution. So essentially what you can do is you save resolution in the end. So, and that, like, again, frees up performance for other applications.
It's like foveated rendering, but for head direction.
In a
certain way, yes. It is
just
like
not dynamic, right? It's always fixed because
it wasn't dynamic in Maxwell, but with Pascal we introduced something called lens match shading, where you're not taking the outer parts of the image and render them at lower resolution and the middle part at just the normal resolution, but you have a dynamically changing or linearly changing resolution across the image. What that means is that you save even a bit more performance. But what's really cool is that since it's lens matched, you actually get a clearer image as well. So because you're rendering the image to the display in a way that's perfectly aligned with how the lenses of the different headsets de-warp that image, you get a clearer image.
So you basically have a different algorithm, so to say, for Oculus, for Vive, for Gear,
and for OSVR. So we're supporting all these three things. And so that's the geometry and the pixel shader part. We have something called preemption, which makes asynchronous time warp more efficient. This is probably a concept that's a little bit hard to.
Let me try to explain it very simple, and if it's fine, we'll just stick to it. Basically, in case of the Gear, if you put it on and you shake your head very strongly, you see that the image can't be rendered that fast. So you basically sometimes see the black around. Now, in a headset that does not have this time warp, you basically would just see the stable image and you would feel sick. But there you see some parts of the image black because the headset moved and the calculation of the movement was perceived, and then it just didn't manage to calculate the whole picture in time. So you basically have half of the image missing, but you still have the rotation of your head. Is it fitting it at least a bit?
That's almost correct. It's not that big of a part. So you will never with asynchronous time warp, you never see half of your image black. And the cool thing about asynchronous time warp is that if you're not looking for it very precisely, you probably don't realize it. And let me try to explain it in another way. When you're looking at how the VR image is generated for the headset, there's the head pose part, then there's the CPU part, and then there's the GPU part.
Yes.
So if you're rendering at 90 FPS, that means that each frame has 11 milliseconds to be processed. During those 11 milliseconds, you could have changed your head position. So what that means is the head pose that the CPU gets at the start of the rendering cycle might be different from the head pose that the user has after those 11 milliseconds have taken. And what you can do with asynchronous time warp is you look at the very last point right before sending the image from the GPU to the headset. You take a last look at the head pose and then you shift that image a tiny little bit. That is in essence what you just also told the audience. But what you can do with preemption in Pascal is usually when looking at that final head pose, usually you have to take a very conservative preemption request because you have to wait until the last draw call of the GPU has finished. In Pascal, you don't have to wait anymore for that draw call to finish. So you can interrupt the GPU at a very fine granularity.
Okay.
And what that means is that you get closer to the send out of the image to the display, and then take a very very last second view at the head pose. So that is and that lowers perceived latency.
How does it interact with the time warp from Oculus?
It's actually implemented with that. So you can use both. It doesn't interfere in any way. It's just a finer way to stop the GPU and put in that head pose, the information that might have changed, and then shift the image just according to that.
Are there any differences in implementation between Oculus, Vive, and so on?
The game engine should take care of it, right?
The game engine usually takes care of it. This is probably a hardcore question for our SDK guys, because they know exactly what type of experiences are working on which headsets, because as you know, the market is a little bit fragmented right now. There's not like one baseline API that developers and hardware manufacturers can talk to. So it's a little bit of a tricky
you're basically taking an approach of integrating all these different approaches and make a one SDK that basically should work with everything. So you're like integrating everything.
It's a comprehensive SDK that integrates all these things. And to your original question, those were the three main things for the graphics side of things. There's also VR SLI, which uses two GPUs.
Exactly. That was my next question, actually.
Exactly. SLI is the system where you use two GPUs, mm-hmm. you bridge them together, and they're working in unison. And
Do they separately render each eye, or do they separately render each frame?
Exactly. You can set up VR SLI in a way that the one GPU number one renders the left eye, and GPU number two renders the right eye, and that means it doubles your performance essentially. And that's also important, but it's more of a small minority of the market that actually has SLI, but it brings a lot of value.
Exactly, so especially for the industrial usage.
Yeah, if you want to put out something really cool with lots of geometry, lots of shaders, you want to have as much performance.
Now, the NVIDIA GPUs also have physics, right?
Yeah,
so physics. I guess also supporting VR.
Physics is also part. So the main things that we cover are graphics, audio, touch, what we call the physics API, so haptics also. And then 360 video content is also part. Mm-hmm. And then a proper physics simulation, which is also important. And physics is part of two things. So first of all, the physics simulation. If you're in a virtual reality experience, usually physics effects have to be even more convincing than on a traditional 2D screen, because your brain, again, is very much trained on exactly knowing how the real world works. So for example, if you splash a bucket of water or a bucket of paint onto a wall, you know exactly how that paint will behave. You don't have to, like, there's an image in your head of how the fluid behaves. And if it's different in virtual reality, that lowers your sense of immersion. Because if you splash a bucket of paint on the wall and it looks super weird in VR, you're going to be like, what is this? This is not real life. And your brain immediately loses the immersion and the mm-hmm. sense of illusion.
Now, before we go more to the industrial use cases that Chris is so eager about to ask, one last question. So NVIDIA is also heavily in the whole AI business, right?
Yes.
And could you say that the same as for the buckets and the color splashing, you would also expect the NPCs to behave smarter, and then you could also reuse the GPU for that because it provides a certain CUDA cores for AI? So
of course. There's two things that you could do with modern GPUs, because GPUs aren't used anymore just for 3D rendering. They can also be used for general purpose calculations, which is GPU. And two of the things that you just named are AI. So you could make NPCs smarter. They could behave in a way where you just imagine a game like Skyrim, where you could actually talk to the people, not by clicking one of the three options, but just going there and saying, hey, how's your day? And the AI will know how the day of the NPC was, whether he was attacked or whether he had a good day on the farm.
Or took an arrow to the knee.
Very nice. Nice one.
Can I already pre-order that?
I would love to play a game like that.
It's future, but it's
so
possible,
AI,
right?
AI is one of the big topics. So, I mean, you guys are all tech enthusiasts. Yeah. I mean, I don't have to tell you. AI is one of these things that might revolutionize a ton of industries and also the lifestyle of a lot of people. So just imagine an AI that reads your emails for you and tells you the most important stuff within 5 minutes.
I would
so pay for that.
Me too.
There is actually a whole topic of white collar workers being jobs being removed because AI can substitute them.
Of course, it's ethics. It's going to happen one way or another. It's just quite fascinating that coming from this cognitive science perspective, the GPUs enable you to have like 30, 40 times more faster AI simulation, and also those deep neural networks that are currently so hyped are just basically possible because of GPU acceleration. Otherwise, you just cannot run them on a CPU. Yep. So in general, the whole science of AI was pushed strongly by this.
Super strongly. And we're in a very lucky position. I mean, you guys, I don't know if you guys watched the NVIDIA stock price in the last couple of months.
240%.
It went up pretty well. And I only joined the company 7 months ago. Mm-hmm. But I completely understand why the stock price went that way, because we're in a lucky position.
You have Tegra in each Tesla.
It's not only that. It's more the general direction that the company will head in. Because we were in a lucky position where we have a CEO that realized that these fields are perfectly suited for being used in conjunction with our GPUs.
Exactly.
Because things like AI, autonomous driving, deep learning, those are all things that will take a huge part of the future.
Yes.
And NVIDIA is set up very well in terms of profiting from that market growth. Mm-hmm. And deep learning is the other thing that I just wanted to talk about in our Elder Scrolls Skyrim example. Imagine just from the way you behave with the NPCs, the machine learns about your character and then uses that information that it gathered about your behavior to be reflected in the world.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so you have you not only have NPCs that are smart, that actually react
smart,
to the
right?
stuff that you're saying, but you also have the world in general reacting towards your behavior, mm-hmm. which is something that is mm-hmm. that would be pretty great in a VR experience. But
definitely.
Deep learning is something that's huge in a ton of other industries.
Yes, definitely. We can, I think, at this point say that there are Oculus, HTC, and other hardware manufacturers that provide the hardware for the developer. So it's basically, you know, cutting edge as much as they can. And you obviously also have the GPU and CPU part that has to be really good. And what we so far learned from you is that through tricks and certain improvements in the GPU architecture or certain extra features, you can support VR even more. Now, let's go for some time away from the gaming example.
Can I actually have a stupid question?
Yeah.
I am absolutely oblivious to how technology works. I'm
Bring it.
Totally for using the technology.
Hey,
so,
mom.
Can you tell me what's the difference between CPU and GPU?
Okay, CPU is a central processing unit and GPU is a graphics processing unit.
That I know, but like on the like how it works.
You
level.
Can program the CPU. You can basically give it different commands that it does once per hertz, right? And the GPU is rather fixed calculation that it does. It does rather just geometry that Dominic was referring to, and you can reuse it for the deep neural networks, but you can't do all the calculation that CPU is doing on the GPU, just parts of it.
Exactly. So a CPU is more of a general approach.
Yeah.
A CPU can... Essentially, a CPU could also do the stuff that a graphics processing unit is doing or that a physics processing unit is doing, but very slow. Then again, it's more versatile, so you can use it for any type of computation. A GPU was very much specialized on particular calculations. So, for example, for a pixel shader, you always use the same kind of algorithms. And if you build the hardware in a way that it can profit from the fact that it knows how the software is running it. You get more performance out of it. So essentially, a GPU is more specialized. But with things like CUDA and the GPGPU movement, that all turned out to change. So right now, you can use, if you speak to the hardware the right way through the
and
API,
you have the right tasks that can be fragmented in different parallel ways.
Exactly.
Like if you do say anti-aliasing, or you do something in Photoshop, but you need to perform a filter pixel-wise, you can basically accelerate each pixel because the GPU can do all the pixels simultaneously, while the CPU had to do it over and over for each pixel, right?
Yep.
But is a GPU a full Turing machine, like a CPU? Can a GPU technically calculate everything, or is it really a subset?
I think it's a subset,
okay.
But it's again within that subset. It's very powerful.
So you have
tons of computation power because GPUs made bigger steps in terms of raw processing power than CPUs did because they were able to specialize first and do special calculations, and then from those learnings, you're able to use that the knowledge you gained for actually general purposes as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for not roasting.
Well, I mean, it's a question that
it's a very good question.
Yeah.
I mean, many people aren't really thinking about the power that's coming out of the outlet or the frames that are being displayed on the PC monitor. So it's a completely valid question.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure if I answered that correction completely correctly, because that's a whole topic where there's a ton of experts out there that know exactly that.
Moving to more industrial applications, that's our lovely topic, and science applications. We already mentioned deep learning and simulation and other things. Now, if you are a production planner, or you are someone working with huge data to simulate in order for determining the flow of fluids in a machine. How can you benefit when you combine it with VR and you kind of want to look around from the NVIDIA framework, from the GPUs, and how is NVIDIA addressing this particular use case? Like, you have GPUs for professional use case, right? They are called, what are they?
The Quadro series. So the Quadro series is something that is meant especially for professional developers. On the one hand, it has more processing power and more memory than the usual product line. What you also get is when you're running your application on just normal consumer grade hardware, we can't guarantee that your software will run stably on that hardware. Mm-hmm. Because especially if you're going into research or professional applications, it's usually not easy stuff that you're doing. It's complex. Yep. It might involve some new algorithms, you name it. So essentially what you can do with the Quadro series, you get a guarantee that your code will run on these hardware on that hardware stable. So you get that guarantee, and you also get all the support. So if you're buying a professional graphics card, you obviously want professional support as well, because going to a trade show and your code isn't running,
that's sad.
Who you're gonna call?
Do the Quadro GPUs also have
NVIDIA?
Yeah, Ghostbusters, NVIDIA. One of those two great people companies. Does the Quadro GPU has also all the VR features that you described before?
It actually has a couple more. So there's a couple things that are only meant for professional developers, and if you're looking at anything that's B2B or professional, the Quadro series definitely is the better choice. It's obviously more expensive because you get all that added extras, but one of the things we showed at GTC in Amsterdam, for example, was running on two Quadro GPUs, two of our Pascal Quadro GPUs. And it was essentially a CAD visualization. So there was a complete car model with each individual tile, which each individual piece, no matter whether it's a...
And it was in the CAD format.
It was in CAD format.
So you basically did live tessellation?
Exactly. Okay. And culling as well.
And
culling. So
to our audience, the CAD files are not as triangles that you usually would know from the mesh or... from the 3D objects you have, but they are rather mathematical formulas.
Exactly.
And in order to display that, you need to tessellate it, and tessellation means, correct me if I'm wrong, basically going from the NURBS format to the triangle, right?
Exactly.
And after you did that, you end up, because there are so many small parts and CAD is not optimized to be very well runnable in VR, there is a lot of stuff that you don't see. What usually happens in games is that things that you don't see get cowed away, like it's called culling, and you showed some kind of very aggressive culling that you had there, or...
It was, again, I can't go into too much details because our pro visualization team was building that, but they built a very powerful culling algorithm that actually allowed you to display the whole model with, I think, 70 million polygons.
Which is very
much. It's a lot, so a typical game scene has...
10 million.
17. If there's a lot happening on screen. Yeah.
Just the relation, when you have a Gear VR application, you have to limit yourself to 100K.
Yep.
So just to relate it.
Yep. So a ton of polygons, so to speak, and that is something you only get out of the Quadro series. So if you want to do something professional like that, that is probably your best choice. And then, sorry to step back I forgot one thing about the VRWorks SDK. That would be nice. We're talking about 360 video content. Mm-hmm. So we have a 360 video SDK that allows you to do real-time stitching on a GPU, which if you're a producer of 360 videos, it's pretty helpful because what the usual production workflow that you have right now is you put your big ball of cameras, like six GoPros or whatever, inside of the scene. And then you shoot the scene, and then in the end you stitch it, and then you look at it through equirectangular image or through a VR headset, and only then you realize that we missed that shot. That shot didn't work in the way that we thought it would. And what you can do with real time stitching on a GPU is you go out into the production set, into the field, and you put up your camera and you can live stitch the image, and you can essentially see, do the seams work? Does the setup of the actors work? Are they too close to the camera or too far away?
And you can also stream it directly.
And you can also stream it directly. And then
there's the hot topic right
and
now.
And there's GPU acceleration for things like stitching, for example.
Which is really impressive. Light fields.
Okay, you want to talk about light
fields? I want to talk about light fields.
He always wants to talk about light fields.
I'm not really understanding because I'm completely and fully.
I love this podcast.
Is there anything accelerated in terms of light fields?
The only things that I can say about light fields is that it's definitely something that's interesting. I mean, obviously, it could be the type of content generation that is very important in the future.
I mean, to give a context why I'm speaking about light fields, sure. Just imagine we just spoke about the CAD files and you have this huge car and you kind of want to figure out whether it looks right when there is some kind of different light shining on it. So you basically want to understand how the object looks when it's light. Are there any reflections that annoy the driver, right?
Yep.
And to do that photorealistic, you either have to have one frame per day or build it out of clay, I guess. But then you would have pre-calculated light fields that are basically going from different directions. So for someone who doesn't know light fields, I guess you could describe it as you have a camera and you have to refocus it. And you usually have only one focus. With a light field camera, you have all the focuses, so you could, what you usually do with a zoom on a camera and the focus, you can refocus it afterwards. Yep. And the camera just captures one picture, but the light fields in terms of a scene are basically this information from every angle in every direction, which sounds a lot. It's gigabytes of data. You can also compress that. But if you would have that, you would have actually photorealistic pre-computed light fields, and you could actually walk around the car and look everywhere. It would like look super awesome, but that's very tough to do, right?
It's pretty tough to do because it's computationally very, very expensive. So you have to do a lot of calculation to have a full light field. The thing is, there are two things that we're doing at NVIDIA. One of them, we were actually one of the first ones to develop a light field display.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that information. So you have a volume that you recorded where all the different light field informations are inside.
We will link the video from YouTube. It's really awesome.
It's pretty cool, yeah.
Because what you have is a fatigue of eyes, right? When you look all the time at one focus plane, your eyes get tired. And this is what an HMD right now it is. But just imagine your eyes could actually refocus. And this is something that potentially in the future, the prototype you showed could do, right?
Yeah. We're gonna do a little experiment with the audience, so we can actually explain what we're just talking about. If every one of you and Peter, Chris, please do that as well. Put one finger in front of your head, about 30 centimeters. That's how many inches? 10 inches? About
10,
10 inches away from your face. Just one finger, and close one eye if you can do that. And now focus on the finger, and then focus on the stuff that's behind it. You'll realize that your eyes are actually focusing on different planes.
Yes.
And thus, if you're focusing on the back plane, your finger gets blurred.
Yeah.
And that's essentially something you can't replicate in VR headsets right now because you're only looking at one focus plane. Everything is always crystal clear in a VR headset.
Yeah, doesn't matter where you look.
Exactly. It doesn't matter what your eyes are focusing on. If you're using a light field display, and that's the thing that we built, that our tech team at NVIDIA built, you can actually do that. So you can focus on different parts of the image, and the other parts of the image will look blurred, just like your eye is working in the real world.
Yeah,
and that means it's a more convincing way of
looking.
They had
two different screens and some kind of membrane that was interpolating it.
Yes,
that's multiple totally transparent fine. Screens behind each other.
My question is, where do you get information on which plane do I look?
That's from
your eyes. Your
that's
eyes
from eye tracking. That's from eye tracking.
How good eye tracking do you need to have?
Wait
a second. So if you want to do it in a VR headset, you'd have to have eye tracking to simulate the blur. You could simulate the blur. I mean, essentially,
okay, you can simulate it, but if you have a light field display, you don't need any eye tracking.
If you have a light field display, you don't need the eye tracking because your eyes are just focusing on the different planes within the display. So imagine a stack of transparent displays behind each other
focus points.
With different focus points, and your eyes can actually do that. They can focus whatever, 10 millimeters away, 12 millimeters away, 20 millimeters away, 20 meters away.
Okay.
So by having different focus planes that you can focus your eyes on, you actually get the feeling of, hey, I'm looking not at a display, but I'm looking more through a window at a real scene.
You could use an eye tracker in a normal display, and you basically would track the pupil dilation, I would say.
Yeah.
but it's not perfect because the eye can also change the crystal inside basically through the muscles. So it's not just only the pupil dilation, but there are like more muscles and more effects involved how you reshape your vision.
On that short distance, pupil is no longer a reliable tracking point.
Yeah.
Probably not to the degree that it's really realistic. But I mean, a similar thing has been implemented in games for a long time, which is called depth of field, which essentially means that in a game like Skyrim, for example, mm-hmm. if you're looking at the town that's right in front of you, all the back parts are getting blurred.
True.
If your crosshair is on the mountain parts, on the mountain range in the distance, the town part in the front gets blurred.
Funny.
And you could use a eye tracking system where you just look at
just as a gate.
Where is your eye looking
and
at that very moment.
Determine the planes, yeah.
Determine the
True.
Plane that it's looking at. Use the Z-buffer information of how far away that part is. And then you could just blur it.
However,
that
still would not fix the fact that the screen is just fixed in front of you.
Your eyes, in a subconscious way, will always realize that they're not looking at the real world.
Which is bad for the eyes, technically. So
it's technically actually bad for the eyes because there's a system where convergence and focus of the eye is a system that's intertwined in the visual system. So if you do the same experiment that we just did with two eyes, you realize that when you're looking with two eyes open, if you realize that if you're looking at the back plane again, you'll see two fingers.
Yeah.
That's convergence for you. And that movement of the eyes looking back and forth between the two planes is very much intertwined. So as soon as you're converging on a different plane, you're also focusing on it.
Yeah.
If you're converging on a different object, you're already focusing onto that onto that thing at the same time. And that is something that is not being replicated in virtual reality headsets right now. So you are converging, but your eye focus isn't changing.
Yeah.
And that could be a problem it's not scientifically proven or anything.
Not yet.
This could be a problem for children that are still developing that intertwined mechanism.
If they wear the headset basically 8 hours a day for years.
So if they learn, if they look at VR more than real life, that would probably be bad.
It would be very bad to let your child be.
But in general, what we see is that as long as it's not a long time, it's not a big problem for children to use it.
Sure.
I mean, it's the same if you're looking at a TV all day.
Exactly.
You're also just focusing on one plane and not training your eyes in any way. There's no natural.
That's right.
Natural movement involved when you're consuming media.
I totally agree. There, you just should look out for your children. If you put it for a day on them or like 1 hour, nothing bad will happen.
Yep.
Coming back to the topic.
To the topic of light fields.
Yeah.
We actually have the iRay renderer.
iRay, yeah.
That's something that could be interesting to you. What it does, it gives you a volume in which you can move around. So even in VR, you can move your head around and you get super photorealistic reflections. Because it's not rendered in real time, the whole scene or the whole light field volume is pre-rendered, and then it only gets output at the moment that the user looks at it.
Okay.
There's the plus side is you have real photorealistic rendering, so you can do things like global illumination, ray tracing, whatever. Mm-hmm. So each ray of light is hitting your eye exactly in the way that you would expect it to.
And I mean, there is also a lot of things you can optimize on the game engine level. So you described a lot that you can do on the GPU level, but there are also a few things that you can do. And the what you just mentioned goes in that direction, that you can basically pre-calculate light, pre-calculate shadows, pre-calculate occlusion.
Yep.
You can have occlusion mapping, you can have depth maps, you can have different ways that basically are telling the GPU to render less.
Yep.
So you can do it before, and those steps that you described are already happening on the GPU. So they're basically like a multi-step optimization you have to do that creates that. And you can also basically take different shaders, for example, not for global anti-aliasing, but just for the textures that you're generating. So there are like a lot of small tweaks here and there. So the question is, if you're not doing anything of that, not doing any features, and you're doing everything, what's the performance difference? Like, I'm a very stupid guy. I'm like, by heart, destroying with a screwdriver all those chips that you carefully implement on the GPU. I don't want any of that. I was just pro performance. Or I'm like a super smart guy that have read all the SDKs, all the optimizations. We have literally the same scene. What would be the difference? Like 100%, 200%?
It's very hard. I'm probably not going to be able to give you a
just
number.
Rough
because
estimation. Because from my experience as a developer, I did here and there some things in Unity. It's definitely not 10%. It's at least half or more. But I guess it's even more when you take all the...
If you do all the rendering tricks, and it depends on your measurement. So if you're taking how realistic it looks, for example, as a measurement, it's very hard to tell
exactly. Because
it's different from...
But
from
frames
from
per second, I guess you just can...
Yeah, but if you're taking particles that yeah. you can use, the amount of, let's say, the amount of particles, the amount of geometry, and the amount of pixel shader power that you have,
So it's not linear scaling. It's whether you want to have more particles or you want to have maybe something else. You just get
exactly.
more computational powers that you can use to improve something in the scene. Okay.
So if you're using it in a correct way, all these KPIs will go up tenfold, if not even a hundredfold, for the particle effects, for example. Mm-hmm. Because if you're using just a normal CPU particle system, there's not a lot happening on screen. If you're going for a full GPU system, that's probably in the hundredfold of particle effects or the amount of particles that you can have on screen at the same time.
Sweet.
It's hard to tell because. Well, some people can implement stuff even without reading any SDK tutorials, right? They're just magicians. I mean, John Carmack would probably implement VRWorks within a second.
I guess John Carmack would not take the screwdriver and destroy things on your GPU, but screw something more to it. Here's something missing. Let me wire it up a little bit different, right?
Sorry, warranty fried, warranty voided.
I don't think he cares.
He will fix it himself.
He might not. But yeah, it's hard to tell. But in the end, it really doesn't make that much of a difference. Even if it's just 5% or 10% that you have more performance, that's less
it's for free.
Resources that you have to put into optimizing your experience to put it out on the market, for example,
exactly.
in the end. Not to say that you can be lazy.
Sure,
with that, but it frees up resources for other parts.
Now, when we speak about these features that the GPU does, I mean, you're not changing the GPUs every month, right? So
nope.
I guess even if you would right now have some kind of very good and awesome features that you developed and you are ready to put in the GPU, you need to wait for the next iteration. Do you need to speak with the manufacturers like Oculus and HTC a lot, synchronize with them? How difficult it is, or just going and saying, oh, we have just those features, you know?
No. Our tech teams, and especially the SDK guys, are super well aligned. So they are working very closely with Oculus and HTC, mm-hmm. of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, both headset manufacturers or all the headset manufacturers need us, and we need them for VR to succeed. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship.
Mm-hmm.
If we can do something from our side to make the VR experience more performant and thus more immersive, we're going to do it. And if they have the same opportunity, they're going to do it as well.
They definitely go for it.
So obviously, we're talking very closely to HTC and Oculus on a tech level to make sure that the rendering tricks that we are putting into our GPUs are actually being used by the developers that HTC and Oculus are
talking
to.
Do you also talk to Microsoft and their HMD?
Of course. Microsoft has announced a complete product line of VR headsets that can be produced by
different
manufacturers.
So they also have to somehow talk to you, right?
Of course. I mean, we're all running off of the same PC system.
Are they using some kind of their own driver that talks to the GPU? Because I guess there is this open VR, right? It can basically run Oculus and HTC and
OSVR.
And OSVR, yes. But I don't think that the Microsoft headset will use it, right? So have their own implementation? Because that's something that bothers me.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they actually talked about their plans that much. But
what are they going to do? Do they have to reinvent the wheel again? I mean, I'm going to get in 2 days, actually, my Fove. It's called
nice.
Fove, right?
Yeah.
And from what I read, it's also basically the same level as a DK2 from the SDK because they just had to reinvent the wheel and stuff. And when Microsoft has to do it over and over again, why would you do it? Just implement it at the, I don't know, at the OS level. So basically the operational system can take care of it and you just produce hardware, but maybe it will take still a few years.
I obviously can't talk for Microsoft here, but just generally from what they've tried to accomplish in the last couple of years with their business model is they want to provide general APIs like DirectX, for example. They want to make sure that, and that is probably something I can easily say, they want to make sure that people are using Windows PCs.
Yeah, sure.
So they want to have good APIs for developers, so they will use the Windows ecosystem. It's easy as that. And I think Microsoft is on track to see virtual reality as one of those big industries for the future.
And honestly,
so they will probably want to provide again good tools for developers, but in what kind of form?
Yeah.
I can't really say.
But like, when we speak honest, do you see any other way other than Windows to be used for VR? Because the Mac machines don't have enough power.
I also can't talk about Apple.
You just don't have power.
No, right now it's pretty hard to run VR on systems that aren't specced pretty high end. I mean, it's not a real secret. What you could do is enable machines that don't have crazy good GPU powers in the future through doing cloud computing, for example. So I know, bear with me, latency. We announced at CES this year, our CEO Jensen announced GeForce Now for PCs and for Macs. So essentially what that means is virtually each machine besides Linux that is out there on the market in the consumer space at least, can run Witcher 3 at crazy high resolution.
Okay, so the trick is basically you have crazy huge rendering farms that render the game and you stream it.
Yep.
And good luck to you. Every other company that tried it failed. Well, you are doing the GPU, so they kind of get them for free, and I get the idea. It's, I guess, for me as a Mac user, totally something I would try.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's always fascinating that like every other company that tried it so far has literally
but
not been successful.
I've actually followed those streaming companies. So I followed Gaikai before they were bought by Sony, which is now the PlayStation Now system.
Exactly.
And also OnLive, which were the first ones to do it. And I was totally convinced of, wow, this is going to be the future.
Yeah,
me too. This is awesome. Like, this is just so good.
Yeah.
And I actually had the chance, and that was 5 years ago or something, I had the chance to try Gaikai in beta, and I played Mass Effect, and it worked.
Okay. But
miraculously good.
Like, why didn't it took off? Like,
Gaikai, in essence, did took off. They were bought by Sony for $380 million, if I recall correctly.
Price.
So they built a lot of technology.
Half of the money was for the GPUs.
but we had pretty good internet back then. So we had DSL, I think, something like a 6 megabit
connection. You can
stream stuff over that.
750p, it's okay.
Yeah, but if you wanna go higher than that or with lower latency, which brings us back to the topic of virtual reality, it's gonna be a tough thing to do because as you know, the rendering pipeline takes should be below 20 milliseconds so that the latency is...
Basically, 11 milliseconds.
Everything below 20 milliseconds is fine. But if you're doing a whole tour, like if you're sending the CPU and the headpost data off to the server somewhere across the world, that will probably be a little bit more tricky because then the whole round trip of that information takes a little while.
Even the best case, and I mean, in like CS:GO or some other games, you're basically getting 30, 40, 50 milliseconds. I mean, you usually have some kind of crappy provider, firewalls, whatever. It's never going to be good.
So we need a little bit more time to actually
figure out what you can outsource to the cloud.
Yeah, well, we need better connection, we need better bandwidth, we need better infrastructure. It's actually one of the topics last week at DLD in Munich. Last week at DLD, I was actually talking to the EU Commissioner for Digital Society.
Oh, Herr Oettinger.
With Mr. Oettinger. Mm-hmm. And first of all, to just get rid of the meme, he's actually talking very well English. Like, there's this old meme from like 5 years ago or something where they had a speech of him, which was like not the best English that you could have.
Yeah.
Okay. But he's completely fine. Like, we switched back and forth between German and English just to do a little bit meme stopping here. No, but his agenda is essentially... put on a good foundation for future technologies in Europe. And I made very clear that if we want to go the route of having streamable VR experiences,
we need internet.
We need way better infrastructure.
Yes.
I mean, there were four people in the panel. There was Jules from Otoy. So he was kind of the AR side of things. There was a cable provider and also the moderator, which was from the Wall Street Journal. And we all four basically told Mr. Oettinger that, well, if we definitely need better infrastructure, not only for VR, for AR, for autonomous driving, for AI. Like, it's the foundation. Like, imagine a country at the start of the Industrial Revolution that didn't have steam engines because they just didn't have the money to build them. Mm-hmm. Or during the electrical age, people, like a government that wasn't able to provide power lines.
Yeah.
Like, so many industries are built on power lines.
Yeah. Yes.
And so many industries will be built on good internet infrastructure, are built already on the internet infrastructure. And we're only, I mean, in the information age is only, what, 50 years, 50 years old?
Yeah.
Something like that. So we're
it's
only
enormous
starting.
And it's very sad that people are basically not getting it. And I'm very happy that you told it to Mr. Oettinger. And the more people tell it to Mr. Oettinger, the more is the chance that he might get it at some point.
For our American listeners, this is probably a very, very weird topic.
Well, because, but it's already the end of the podcast. Nobody's listening.
Much better there.
Oh, do you have statistics of people?
No, unfortunately.
That would be fun.
Come on.
US is not much better. They have their own problems. Like, you do not have a full city coverage for a single provider.
That's true. That was
you
hilarious.
Go to a different part of the city and you need a different provider.
Yeah. Okay.
Just as one small glimpse into the future, 5G networks are being rolled out till 2020.
Okay.
And they are actually low. They are actually super low latency, which kind of surprised me at first, but it makes total sense because in the future we want to run things like autonomous driving, for example, over over mobile networks.
Yes.
And if you want to have something where cars that are on the same street talk to each other, you have to have super low latency.
It's
and that
hilarious.
will be super useful for things like mobile VR, for
totally.
Example.
It's hilarious that you are faster online over wireless than over a fiber going to my home.
But the thing is, it's infra from an infrastructure standpoint, much easier. It's way harder to dig something into the ground and lay a line than to just put up a tower and then stream it through the air.
Yeah.
But that could be huge for mobile VR. So things like that are gonna help.
We went a little bit off topic.
We did. But I hope
people enjoyed it.
Well, we talked about rendering challenges. One of them is latency and it's gonna get better in the future. So
definitely. It was a pleasure to have you once again as a guest.
Same.
Any last words? Famous.
I'm always enjoying this, guys. I hope the audience had a good fun with us. And
we hope so too.
next time we'll be talking about a different topic, I guess.
Education. I heard it's education.
Education is one of my pet peeves.
Yeah. Well, I would say
I still would like to talk about the haptics feature that you're providing, but that might be a next podcast altogether.
Exactly.
It's actually pretty short. So we're using our existing physics SDK, which already simulates how objects are interacting with each other in a convincing way. And then you use that information for doing the same thing with motion controllers, for example. So you know how objects are interacting.
Okay.
You can also use the same information to provide a good simulation of how a user is interacting with that.
Okay.
So it essentially builds on that and is meant to be a haptics layer which can be worked with all the different motion controllers. So that's the main goal.
For half an hour, so
next episode, we are ready in 1 hour.
Cool.
So I would say thank you very much for joining and goodbye.
See you next time.
See you in virtual reality.